Chia trotted with the rapid, bow-legged gait that the bushman called drinking the wind. He could keep it up from first light in the morning until nightfall. As he went, he talked to himself as if to a companion, replying to his own questions, chuckling at his jokes. Still on the run, he drank from his horn bottle and ate from the leather food bag slung over his shoulder. He was reminding himself of how cunning and brave he was. "I am Chia, the mighty hunter," he said, and gave a little jump in the air. "I have killed the great bull elephant with the poison that tips my arrow." He remembered how he had followed it along the banks of the great river. Doggedly he had kept up the hunt during the time that it had taken the new moon to wax to the full, then wane again. "Not once did I lose the spoor. Could any other man do that?" He shook his head. "No! Could Bakat perform such a feat? Never! Could Bakat have fired the arrow into the vein behind the ear so that the poison was taken straight to the heart of the bull? He could not have done it." The frail reed arrow could barely pierce the thick pachyderm hide. It would never penetrate to heart or lung. He had had to find one of the great blood vessels close to the surface to carry the poison. It had taken the poison 5 days to bring down the bull. "But I followed him all that time, and I danced and sang the hunter's song, when at last he fell like a mountain and raised the dust as high as the treetops. Could Bakat have performed such a feat?" he asked the high peaks around him. "Never," he replied. "Never." Chia and Bakat were members of the same tribe, but they were not brothers. "We are not brothers," Chia shouted aloud, and he became angry. Once there had been a girl, with skin as bright as the plumage of a weaver bird, and a face shaped like a heart. Her lips were as full as the fruit of the ripe marula, her buttocks were like ostrich eggs, and her breasts as round as 2 yellow tsama melons warming in the Kalahari sun. "She was born to be my woman," Chia cried. "The Kulu Kulu took a piece of my heart while I slept and moulded it into that woman." He could not bring himself to say her name. He had shot her with the tiny love arrow tipped with the feathers of the mourning dove to demonstrate to her how much he wanted her. "But she went away. She would not come to lie on the sleeping mat of a Chia the hunter. She went instead with a despicable Bakat and bore him 3 sons. But I am cunning. The woman died from the bite of the mamba." Chia had captured the snake himself. He had found its hiding place under a flat rock. He had tethered a live dove as bait beside it, and when the snake slid out from under the rock, he had pinned it behind the head. It was not a large mamba, only as long as one of his arms, but its venom was virulent enough to kill a bull buffalo. He placed it in the girl's harvesting bag while she and Bakat slept. The next morning, when she opened the mouth of the bag to place a tuber inside, the snake had bitten her 3 times, once on the finger and twice on the wrist. Her death, though swift, was terrible to behold. Bakat wept as he held her in his arms. Concealed among the rocks, Chia had watched it all. Now the memory of her death and Bakat's grief was so sweet that Chia jumped with both feet together like a grasshopper. "There is no animal who can elude me. There is no man who can prevail against my guile. For I am Chia," he shouted, and the echo came back from the cliffs above. "Chia, Chia, Chia." After Colonel Kaiser left him, he had waited 2 days and a night on the hills and in the forests of High Weald, watching for Bakat. On the first morning he saw him come out of his hut in the dawn, yawn, scratch himself, and laugh at the squeal of gas from between his buttocks. For the bushman, a flourish of flatus was always a propitious sign of good health. He watched him let the herd out of the kraal and drive them down to the water. Lying like a partridge concealed in the grass, Chia saw the big white man with the black beard that they called Klebe, the hawk, ride down from the homestead. He was Bakat's master, and the two squatted in the middle of the open field with their heads close together, and they spoke in whispers for a long time so that no one could overhear them. Even Chia was not able to creep close enough to pick up their words. Pierre grinned to watch their secret council. "Hey, I know what you are saying, Klebe. I know you are sending Bakat to find your son. I know you are telling him to take care that he is not followed, but like the spirit of the wind, I, Kia, will be watching when they meet." He watched Bakat close the door of his hut at nightfall and saw the glow of his cooking fire. But Bakat did not come out again until the dawn. "Oh, you try to lull me, Bakat. But will it be tonight or tomorrow?" he asked as he watched from the hilltop. "Is your patience greater than mine? Ha! We shall see." He watched Bakat circle around his hut in the early light, searching the earth for the sign of an enemy, for someone who had come to spy upon him. Kia embraced himself with glee and rubbed his back with both hands. "Ha! Ha! Do you think I am such a fool to come in close, Bakat?" This was the reason he had sat all night upon the hilltop. "I am Kia, and I leave no sign. Not even the high-flying vulture can discover my hiding place." All that day he had watched Bakat go about his business, tending his master's herds. At nightfall, Bakat went into his hut again. Kia worked a charm in the darkness. He took a pinch of powder from one of the stoppered Diker horn flasks on his beaded belt and placed it on his tongue. It was the ash of a leopard's whiskers, mixed with the dry powdered dung of a lion and other secret ingredients. Kia mumbled an incantation as it dissolved in his own saliva. It was the spell for outwitting prey. Then he spat three times in the direction of the hut in which Bakat lived. "This is a charm of great power, Bakat," he warned his enemy. "No animal or man can resist its spell." This was not always true, but whenever it failed, there was always good reason for it. Sometimes it was because the wind had changed direction, or because a black crow flew overhead, or because the sore-eye lily was in bloom. Apart from these and similar circumstances, it was an infallible charm. Having cast the spell, he settled down to wait. He had not eaten since the day before, so now he swallowed a few fragments of smoked meat from his food bag. Neither hunger nor the cold wind off the snows of the mountain deterred him. Like all his tribe, he was inured to pain and hardship. The night was still, proof that his spell was efficacious. Even a small breeze would have covered the sounds for which he was listening. It was soon after the moon had set that he heard a night bird utter its alarm call in the forest behind Bakat's home. He nodded to himself. "Oh, something moves there." A few minutes later he heard the nightjar's mate whirl up from the forest floor, and by correlating the two clues he guessed the direction in which his quarry was moving. He went down the hill, silent as shadow, testing each footfall with his bare toe for twigs or dry leaves that might crackle and disclose his presence. He stopped to listen at every second step and heard down by the stream the dry rustle of a porcupine erecting its quills as a warning to a predator who had ventured too close. The porcupine might have seen a leopard, but Kia knew it had not. The leopard would have lingered to harass its natural prey, but a man moved on immediately. Not even an adept of the sand, such as Bakat or even Kia himself, could have avoided encountering the nightjar or the prowling porcupine in the darkness of the forest. Those little signs had been all that Kia needed to work out how Bakat was moving and the direction he was taking. Another hunter might have made the mistake of closing in too swiftly. But Kia hung back. He knew that Bakat would backtrack and circle to make certain he was not followed. "He is almost as cunning in the lore of the wild as I am, but I am Kia, and there is no other like me." Telling himself this made him feel strong and brave. He found where Bakat had crossed the stream, and in the last rays of the waning moon he picked out a single wet footprint gleaming on the top of one of the river boulders. It was the size of a child's, but broader, and there was no arch. "Bakat," he gave a little hop, "I will remember the shape of your foot all the days of my life. Have I not seen it 100 times running beside the track of the woman who should have been my wife?" He remembered how he had followed their tracks into the bush, so that he could creep up on them and watch them as they coupled, writhing together in the grass. The memory made him hate Bakat with a fresh corroding passion. "But you will never savour those melon breasts again. Thea and the snake have seen to that." Now that he had clearly established the direction and run of the spoor, he could hang back to avoid in the dark the traps that Buckart would surely set for him. "Because he moves in darkness, he will not be able to cover his sign as completely as he would in daylight. I will wait for the coming of the sun to read more clearly the sign he has left for me." In the first flush of the dawn, he picked up the spoor again. The wet footprint had dried, leaving no trace, but within 100 paces he found a dislodged pebble. Another 100 paces, and there was a broken blade of grass, dangling and beginning to wither. Thea did not stop to pore over these clues. A quick darting glance confirmed his instinct and enabled him to make minute adjustments to his direction. He smiled and shook his head when he found where Buckart had lain in wait beside his spoor. Because he had squatted unmoving for so long, his bare heels had left indentations in the earth. Then, much further on, he found where Buckart had made a wide circle to wait again beside his own spoor, the same way as a wounded buffalo circles back to wait for the hunter who pursues him. Thea was so pleased with himself that he took a little snuff, sneezed softly, and said, "No, Buckart, that it is Thea who follows, that Thea is your master in all things." He tried not to think of the honey-yellow girl, the one thing in which Buckart had prevailed. Once the spoor led into the mountains, it became even more elusive. Up one long, narrow valley, he found where Buckart had hopped from rock to rock, never touching soft earth or disturbing a blade of grass or other growing thing, except for the grey lichen that grew sparsely on the rocks. This plant was so dry and tough, and Buckart so light, his soul so small and pliant, that he passed over it almost as softly as the mountain breeze. Thea squinted to pick out the slightly different shade of lichen grey where his foot had touched. Thea kept carefully to the side of the tracks furthest from the rising sun, to highlight the faint spoor and not to disturb it in case he was forced to come back to rework it. Then even Thea was confounded. The tracks climbed a scree slope, again moving from rock to rock. Then abruptly, halfway up the scree, the tracks ended. It was as though Buckart had been plucked into the sky in the talons of an eagle. Thea went on in the established line of spoor until he reached the head of the valley, but he found nothing more. He went back to where the sign ended, squatted down, and turned his head one way, then the other, to contemplate the faint smears on the lichen coating of the rocks. As a last resort, he took another pinch of the magical powder from the dika horn and let it dissolve in his saliva. He closed his eyes to rest them and swallowed the mixture. He half opened his eyes, and through the veil of his own lashes he had a fleeting glimpse of movement, faint shadows like the flicker of bat's wings in the gloaming. When he looked directly at them, they disappeared as though they had never existed. The saliva dried in his mouth, and the skin on his arms prickled. He knew that one of the spirits of the wilderness had touched him, and what he had seen was the memory of Buckart's feet running across the rocks. They were running not upwards, but back down the scree. In that moment of heightened awareness, he realized from the colour of the lichen that Buckart's feet had touched it twice, going up and coming back. He laughed out loud. "Ha! Buckart, you would have deceived any other man, but not here." He moved back down the scree and saw how he had done it, how he had run up the slope, bouncing from rock to rock, and then in mid-stride he had reversed direction and run backwards, his tiny feet falling exactly in the same spoor. The only telltale sign was the slight colour difference of the double tracks. Near the bottom of the slope, the spoor passed under the low branch of a boar bean tree. Lying on the earth beside the tracks was a fragment of dried bark no bigger than a thumbnail. It had recently fallen or been dislodged from the branch above. At this point, the double tracks on the lichen-coated rock suddenly became single tracks again. Thea laughed out loud. "Buckart has taken to the trees like the baboon that was his mother." Thea went to stand under the outspread branch, jumped, caught a hold, and drew himself up until he stood upright, balancing on the narrow branch. He saw the marks Bakat's feet had made on the bark. He ran along them to the main trunk of the tree, slid down to the earth, picked up the spoor again, and ran along it. Twice more Bakat had set him puzzles to solve. The first of these was at the base of a red cliff and cost him more time, but after the boar bean tree he had learned to look upwards and found the place where Bakat had reached up high and traversed hand over hand along a ledge so that his feet had not touched the earth. The sun had started down the sky by the time he reached the place where Bakat had laid the second puzzle. This one seemed to defy even his powers of solution. After a while he felt a superstitious tingle of his nerves that Bakat had worked some counter-charm and grown wings like a bird. He swallowed another dose of the hunter's powder, but the spirits did not touch him again. Instead, his head began to ache. "I am clear. No man can deceive me," he told himself. But even though he said it loudly, he could not dispel the sense of failure that slowly overwhelmed him. Then he heard a sound, dulled by distance but unmistakable. The echoes from the cliffs confirmed it, but at the same time muddled the direction, so that Kia turned his head from side to side to try to pinpoint it. "Musket shot," he whispered. "My spirits have not deserted me. They lead me on." He left the spoor and climbed the nearest peak, squatted there and watched the sky. It was not long before he picked out a tiny black speck high against the blue. Where there is gunfire, there is death, and death has his faithful minions. Another speck appeared, then many more. They coalesced into a slow-turning wheel in the sky. Kia sprang to his feet and trotted in that direction. As he approached, the specks resolved themselves into carrion birds, soaring on fixed wings, turning their repulsive naked heads to peer down at one spot among the mountains below them. Kia knew well all the five varieties of vulture, from the common tawny bird of the Cape to the huge bearded vulture with its patterned throat and triangular fan of tail feathers. "Hey, thank you, old friends," Kia called up to them. Since time beyond memory, these birds had led him and his tribe to the feast. As he came closer to the centre of the spinning circle, he became more furtive, creeping from rock to rock, peering all around with those sharp, bright eyes. Then he heard human voices coming from the far side of the ridge ahead of him, and like a puff of smoke, Kia seemed simply to dissolve in the air. From his place of concealment, he watched the trio loading the butchered meat onto the horses. Somoya he knew well. His was a familiar face in the colony. Kia had watched him win the Christmas Day races from his own master. However, the woman was a stranger.
"Hey, this must be the one that Gwenyama seeks, the woman who escaped from the sinking ship."
He chuckled when he recognized Trueheart tethered beside Drumfire.
"Soon you will return to our master," he promised the mare.
Then he concentrated all his attention on the dainty figure of Bakat, and his eyes slitted with hatred. He watched the little band finish loading the horses and move off out of sight along the game trail that meandered down the valley. As soon as they had gone, Kia ran down to dispute what remained of the eland carcass with the vultures. There was a puddle of blood lying where Jim had cut the eland's throat. It had coagulated to a black jelly, and Kia scooped it up in his cupped hands and dribbled it into his open mouth. Over the past 2 days he had eaten only sparingly from his food bag, and he was famished. He licked every last sticky clot from his fingers. He could not afford to spend much time on the carcass, for if Bakat looked back he would notice that the vultures had not settled immediately and know that something or someone was keeping them in the air. The hunters had not left much for him. There was the long rubbery tube of the small intestines, which they had not been able to carry away. He drew it through his fingers to squeeze out the liquid dung. The coating of excrement that remained gave it a pungent relish, which he savoured as he chewed. He was tempted to use a rock to crack open the mass of leg bones and suck out the rich yellow marrow, but he knew that Bakat would return to the kill, and he would not overlook such an obvious clue. Instead, he used his knife to scrape off the shreds and strips of flesh that still adhered to the bones and ribcage. He stuffed these fragments into his food bag, then using a switch of dried grass to brush away his footprints. The birds would soon obliterate any small traces of his presence that he had overlooked. When Bakat returned to sweep his back trail, there would be nothing to alert him. Chewing happily on strips of the reeking intestines, he left the carcass and went on after Bakat and the white people. He did not follow directly in their tracks, but kept well out on the slope above the valley. At three places he anticipated the twists and turns of the valleys ahead, cut across the high ground where the horses could not go, and intercepted them on the far side. From a distance he picked out the smoke from the camp at Majuba and hurried ahead. He was watching from the peak when they arrived with the horses. He knew that he should go back at once to report to his master his success in discovering the hiding place of the fugitives, but the temptation to linger and gloat over his old enemy, Bakat, was too great to resist. The three men, white, black, and yellow, cut the raw eland meat into thick strips, and the woman sprinkled coarse sea salt from a leather bag onto them, then rubbed it in with her palms and spread out the strips on the rocks to cure. In the meantime, the men threw the lumps of white fat they had trimmed from meat into a three-legged pot on the fire to render it down for cooking or making soap. Whenever Bakat stood up or moved apart from the others, Kia's eyes followed him with the malevolent gaze of a cobra. He fingered one of the arrows in his little bark quiver and dreamed of the day when he would sink the poisoned tip deep into Bakat's flesh. When the butcher's work was done, and the men were tending the horses and the mules, the white woman laid out the last strips of meat to dry. Then she left the camp and picked her way along the bank of the stream until she reached a green pool screened by the bend from the camp. She took off her bonnet and shook out her hair in a glowing cloud. Kia was taken aback. He had never seen hair that colour and length. It was unnatural and repellent. The scalps of the women of his tribe were covered by crisp, furry peppercorns, pleasant to touch and look upon. Only a witch or some other disgusting creature would have hair like this one. He spat to ward away any evil influence she might emit. The woman looked about her carefully, but no human eye could discover Kia when he wished to remain concealed. Then she undressed, stepping out of the baggy clothes that covered her lower body, and stood naked at the edge of the pool. Again Kia was repelled by her appearance. This was no female, but some hermaphroditic thing. Her body was misshapen, her legs were elongated, her hips narrow, her belly concave, and she had the buttocks of a starving boy. The San women gloried in their steatopygia. There was another puff of hair at the juncture of her thighs. It was the colour of the Kalahari Desert sands, and so fine that it did not completely screen her genitals. Her slit was like a tightly pursed mouth. There was no sign of the inner lips. The mothers of Kia's tribe pierced their daughters' labia in infancy and hung stones upon them to stretch them and make them protrude attractively. In Kia's estimation, monumental buttocks and dangling labia were signs of true feminine beauty. Only her breasts proclaimed this woman's sex, yet they, too, were strangely shaped. They thrust out pointedly, and the pale nipples pricked upwards like the ears of a startled dick-dick. Kia covered his mouth and giggled at his own simile. "What man could want a creature like that?" he asked himself. The woman waded out into the pool until the water reached her chin. Kia had seen enough, and the sun was sinking. He slipped back over the skyline and set off at a trot towards the flat-topped mountain, blue and ethereal in the distance, that showed above the southern horizon. He would travel on through the night to bring the news to his master.